Hello, my name is Guy Somerset, and I'm the Books and Culture Editor of the New Zealand Listener. Welcome to this, the second of this year's New Zealand Listener Book Club podcasts. This month we're discussing how to get filthy rich in rising Asia. I always keep forgetting to include some of the words in that, filthy or rising. But how to get filthy rich in rising Asia, the new novel from Mohsin Hamid, who is the author previously of The Reluctant Fundamentalist and before that Moth Smoke. With me to discuss the book this month, we have Bronwyn Wiley-Gibb of the University Bookshop in Dunedin, Stella Chrysostomo of Page and Blackmore Bookshop in Nelson, and a newcomer, Briar Laurie, of the University Bookshop up in Auckland, confusingly to University Bookshops there. I hope I won't get confused as we go on. Thank you all for joining us this month. To kick off, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the sort of, I guess, the overarching conceit, literary conceit of the book, which is being written in the second person as a how-to business guide or how-to self-help guide. Start with you, Bronwyn. How did that work for you, being addressed in the second person in that manner?
I liked it. I loved the way that he managed to the titles of each chapter are those generic sort of self-help book titles, you know, how to do this, how to do that, this is what you do next. And I loved how he managed to put that together with the novelistic form of the book, and how that, I thought that dovetailed really well, because if it would read just as a normal novel, if you know what I mean, without those titles of the chapters. But with the titles of the chapters, it really sort of emphasizes that this is sort of a matter of luck and choices and missed or taken opportunities. And I thought that was really interesting. It made you think about how this could be anywhere in Asia. And people are reading these books, and you can follow the advice that they give, and nothing may change, or things may change, and it really doesn't have anything to do with the book. I really liked it.
I don't know if any of us have read self-help books. I confess I don't think I have read many. I don't know. Briar or Stella, have you read any? I mean, is it a pretty effective satire of that mode of writing? Briar?
Well, I can't say that I am a particular reader of self-help books myself either, but I agree with Bronwyn. It was totally... it was really interesting to sort of see how this really sort of quite generic-seeming framework that, you know, I would assume is fairly, you know, common through self-help books in general, did manage to just correspond to the framework of the novel without, you know, sort of distracting in any way apart from the beginning of each chapter. You really do sort of get so immersed that you forget that this is the overarching way that he's telling the story. So I think it was really a successful way of bringing a completely new sort of spin onto things, really.
It's not an often used mode. I mean, leaving aside the self-help aspect of it, writing in the second person isn't a very often used mode. Previously, he used it in The Reluctant Fundamentalist. Stella, can you? I can't think of another novel I've read that has addressed me like that. Can you? Other than maybe The Reluctant Fundamentalist itself?
Well, The Reluctant Fundamentalist was such a stunning novel because you really were sort of totally absorbed in these two characters that you're kind of at a loss as well to keep up with their conversation. But I think he really pulls it off in this book. I think it's very clever. And writing in the second person is very difficult. It's very difficult to make that convincing, to draw the reader in. So I think it's very successful. And you know, the whole guise of the self-help manual just is really inspired to enable him to do that and to enable the reader to weigh in as well. And I like that it's very playful, and as someone mentioned, the chapter headings, they're pithy and they're funny, but they're also very cynical, which makes them very enjoyable as a reader. And you know, I had the sense that I was sort of standing alongside the protagonist, but also looking, you know, down from above at the protagonist, because you have this interesting narrative where it is the you. So, yeah, no, I thought it was very clever, worked really well.
Bronwyn and Briar, have you read The Reluctant Fundamentalist?
No, I haven't. I'm planning to go back and read it now, because going back to your last question, I really like the sense that the all-seeing godlike narrator, I like the feeling of him manipulating things, really, and also that he's another one of the characters, really, and that perhaps you're reading this novel that he is writing, and that you're aware that it is being written. And yeah, I liked all those layers of it, and I definitely now want to go back and read The Reluctant Fundamentalist.
Bronwyn, have you read it?
No, that was me talking just.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
Sorry, I should have said it's Bronwyn.
Yeah. I must point out to anybody listening that I'm sitting in Wellington on a Skype without seeing any of these people who I've probably never met in my life. So it's all very confusing. Sorry for me, if not anybody else. Sorry, Briar, in that case, have you read it?
Yes. No, I've not read it either, but it's certainly on my to-do list now. I vaguely heard of, I guess probably just on some booker listings and stuff when the long list and short lists come out, but I wasn't really aware of him as an author. But I'm definitely planning to investigate further everything he has to offer, to be honest. It was a thoroughly enjoyable read.
Well, I would point you in the direction of his first novel, actually, Moth Smoke, and I wasn't actually asking that question to catch anybody out, find out who had done their homework or whatever, who had read him. The main reason I asked was because, for me, I felt this was, as was his first novel, a more vibrantly written novel than The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which I really liked, but this has much more vitality in its language and its broadness. Stella, did you find that, having the one of other person
yes.
who's read it?
I have. Yeah, The Reluctant Fundamentalist I was very impressed with. But it's a very... It's narrow because it's just a conversation between two people. And I won't say much about it because I don't want to spoil it for anyone, because it's excellent and people should go and read it. And at the time it came out, it was very apt because of the focus on terrorism, the focus on spying, the whole focus on Pakistan and what was happening there, sort of undercover. And you have a man that is talking to another man. One of them is a CIA operative, I think, and the other one is a young man who turned a yihadi, basically. So it was a really interesting conversation that brought up a lot of issues around terrorism. But I think with How to Get Filthy Rich in Asia, he uses humour a lot more, and I think it's more accessible. And I don't think either is better than the other, one or the other.
Oh, no, just very different, yeah. Different
They're
books, different styles.
But at the same time, I think his clarity of writing and the way he develops his protagonists is quite similar.
I was interested in there in your description of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, because pretty much that's how it's always been pitched to me. Mm. And I hadn't read it previously. I read it before reading this one, and I was really surprised to discover that actually probably two-thirds more of it is a love story. A huge amount of it is actually devoted to what is a love story, and that is the case here too. I mean, it has been described, reviewed as... being all about, obviously, corruption and so forth, on people on the make in Asia. But at the center of it is that wonderful story with, I think she's described, isn't she, as the pretty girl. Nothing more than that. And, it's a lifelong love affair. What did you make of that aspect of it, Bronwyn?
I thought it was beautiful. And I thought it was really interesting because it's all about how to get filthy rich in rising Asia. And I don't want to say too much, but in the end, what's important is not actually what you've amassed and how much power and wealth you have, but sort of who you've met along the way and the love that you've experienced in your life. And I thought that was beautifully done. And yeah, I also thought there are aspects of it that how to get filthy rich anywhere in the world. So you could, perhaps in some places you don't have to be prepared to use violence, but in most places you have to be prepared to befriend a bureaucrat and avoid idealists and get an education in order to do this. But I thought that it was even more universal, the love story, and I thought it was beautifully done. And in between these things about this man becoming filthy rich and creating his... everyday life, there's these moments which are just beautiful about these two people and how they sort of come together, then they sort of get thrown apart again. And it made me think a little bit of sort of the South American writers and that sense that this is just what happens in life, and life is turmoil, and you can't always be with the person you love all the time. But it might or might not work out in the end, but well, it's fine. It's okay. I liked it.
How did that aspect work for you, Briar?
Well, I probably agree with Bronwyn and Claude's points, but it was especially interesting that, the love story did become so crucial to this stories that involved, especially by the end of the book, when, you know, one of the very early chapter titles was explicitly Don't Fall in Love, and yet, you know, even if his sort of committed marriage and stuff wasn't necessarily one of a love relationship, no matter what he did, he couldn't seem to avoid this, you know, coming and going love relationship with the pretty girl. So, you know, despite everything that he's rising through and following the supposed sort of omniscient advice of the narrator with the avoiding of the idealists and being prepared to use violence and all that jazz, ultimately, one of the very first lessons is the one that he can follow the least, really. And I guess that sort of is, you know, a universal kind of thing. As Bronwyn said, you know, the love story is sort of the one that is the one that you can't avoid, really.
Yeah. The characterization in the novel, given that, you know, it's written in this style, and we'd never actually learn the name of either the pretty girl or indeed of the central protagonist, but did you feel that the characters were fully rounded out nonetheless, Stella?
Oh, absolutely. They were very full characters, but, I mean, particularly the protagonist, because you get this whole cradle to death kind of scenario. So, you know, you're following him, you're understanding him, you're seeing him, you get the sense of his parents and his family and the people around him, the people that support him but also abuse him. And so his character is very full. And I think the character of the pretty girl works really well. It's quite interesting because they're both specific and universal. So that's, again, you know, like Ron was saying, the universal love story. You know, you've got these universal characters as well. You can recognise them straight away. And I think that his characters are very well developed. Even the bit parts are kind of like you get them.
Yeah. The wife, I think, is well drawn to.
I think that's a very, very subtly drawn, and she's quite a complex character. Her position and her kind of motivations as well as her role in the story is quite important.
The sense of where the book is set, obviously it's unspecified, Rising Asia. As you read it, did you have in your own heads a kind of idea of which countries it might be, Bronwyn?
Yeah, that was one of the things I loved most about it, both the anonymity of the names of the characters and the just not knowing quite where it was. And I was still thinking, well, it's probably Pakistan in some way because this is where the author's from, but I've only travelled in India, so for me I was thinking about sort of Calcutta and Bombay, and then I also was thinking, well, it could actually be any big city on any coast, and even in Southeast Asia, because he's very careful to, he talks in a generic way about temples and communities. He doesn't sort of even name religions that people belong to, and you're not quite sure, and the interconnecting of clans and families is something that you find everywhere. So it works really well, and you get, every now and then I'll be like, I wish, I'll be a little bit frustrated, but simply just because I wanted to know, but it actually really didn't actually make any difference. And in fact, it was one of the sort of the delightful things about it, that it was, the story was untethered to place and all the other things that you might think that you know about the place. So in actual fact, it was very freeing.
And while you're reading that, I mean, it's kind of a given, but I would think, I mean, I've not written a novel, but I would think that actually, technically speaking, that would be very hard to sustain, Briar, wouldn't it? You're kind of making sure that you're not actually pinning it down.
Absolutely. I was really, it was by the end of it when I sort of was, you know, obviously you're aware the whole time that nothing's been specifically specified like that. It's pretty amazing to actually maintain this continuous story and continuous narrative and feeling like you are familiar with the places and the characters without having any kind of actual knowledge of where they are and what's happening and, you know, what, I mean, apart from just the hugely generic term of Asia, nothing more specific than that, apart from what you can eke out from knowledge about the author himself and, you know, sort of assumptions you make therein. But, yeah, along with the whole second-person narrative, it really makes you sort of appreciate just how, obviously, talented at writing Milton Hamid is as an author, because neither of those are easy things to sustain, I'm sure.
It's a novel, it can do what it likes, but one thing it's doing with the time frame is that I actually asked him about this, and it's actually the permanent present, as it were. There, you know, it is. I mean, it's spanning a man's life, but we're not actually going from, you know, the 1960s or 1950s through to the present day or onwards a little bit. It is actually all the present day. Novelists can do that sort of thing, can't they, Stella? And you don't necessarily stop and think about it too much.
No, you don't stop and think about it. And it was interesting that you just pointed that out, because yes, you don't have a sense of time. In the sense of a period of time, but you do have a sense of time, and you're following his aging. So I think, yeah, it's quite interesting, because you're kind of set in a wee bubble, really, in a way. And again, you know, it's that kind of, the characters aren't named, the place isn't named, the date isn't there. So it's kind of fitting that he's done that.
Yeah. The one thing that feels particularly contemporary, particularly today, sitting in Wellington on another dry, hot day with talk of water shortages, is the fact that water is the kind of method by which he attempts to make his fortune. I thought those sequences were very funny. I particularly loved the, you know, the rebottling of, well, it was probably, I say I loved it and thought it was funny. I suspect it's happening and it's not very funny at all, but the rebottling of water into fancy new bottles that made it look like it was much purer than it was, Bronwyn. I thought that was funny, yeah. And also very apposite.
Yeah, I found that really interesting, because I travelled in that area when I was a child, and we weren't allowed to touch the water, and we had all these things of purifying it that we had to follow, and we just wouldn't ever touch the water, even when it came in bottles and all those sorts of things. And I brought back a lot of those memories, and the fear that you have if you are sort of from outside of that region and you're travelling and then seeing people just drink what they can, because you have to just at some point you have to actually just not worry about these things, because you have no other choices. And it makes you feel very, very privileged to sort of sit where you can just turn the tap on and take water out of it.
Yes, well, hopefully yeah. We still will be able to in Wellington in 20 days' time.
Yes.
Not the comment to make when actually we're nowhere near the conditions of other parts of the world on that front. Corruption is the other area that the book looks at, those sort of meetings with bureaucrats and the wheeling of the oils and so forth. Stella, what did you make of those parts of the novel? That seems a very well kind of drawn sense of how that kind of country works.
Well, I kind of think of ageism. Capitalism meets chaos. Chaos meets capitalism. So, yeah, it's ultimately this sort of self-destructive pattern, which is thriving in capitalism anywhere. I thought that was quite interesting, and I quite like those dealings they had to have with bureaucrats and the changing of money and the kind of, you know, wheeling and dealing and the bribery, and
yeah.
Ultimately it bites them back, because of course it's always going to be the strongest and the most devious that, and you know, sort of enabled to aspire and climb over one and another.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. I found that quite humorous, especially, you know, the bureaucrats and the officers, with, you know, they know they've got power, and unless you can pay, you can't get anywhere.
The thing that struck me about the book was, coming to it not having read him before, was, and you know, the topic. If you described the book in its general terms to somebody, they might think it's a little bit eating your gruel, learning about these things. But the thing that struck me about the book is it's such an alive and human book. It's really feels very, very humanized. These big issues are kind of woven into a very human life story. Bronwyn and Briar coming to Mossin Hamid, not having read him before, what were you expecting, and were you pleasantly, or were you surprised at all?
Well, I have
I'll
to
go
say that.
Oh, sorry.
You go, Briar. Okay. When I first heard the title of the book, having no background in Mossin Hamid's work at all, I was a bit perplexed and wondering exactly where the book club was going to with this apparent new self-help direction before I was reassured it was a novel. But it really is definitely a case of a very human story, but in some ways I suppose you can almost take from it your own sort of self-help perspective of it, because it is quite sort of, I suppose, because it goes to such general human traits and things that are approached through the book, you sort of are reassured that it's the same everywhere, you know, in this generic Asian city that is never specified, these same things that we're all aware of in whatever countries in the world we may be reading this book. You know, they're things that can happen to anyone without the sort of specific circumstances necessarily being exactly the same. But so it almost in that sense does become a self-help book, or at least a sort of a affirmation type book, kind of.
Roman?
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that, Brad, because I came away from it thinking, oh, I'm really energized by this. This is really exciting. And I thought, just like these books are supposed to make you feel, and then you go out and conquer the world. And, I thought it was, in the end, my sense of it, despite all the different things that happen and the things he has to do, and that there's a joyfulness about it because it is so alive, and it is, it makes you feel, sort of excited and interested, and I thought that he captured that really well. That it's sort of life in all its range, and it's beautiful. And I've been madly recommending it to people because I think the title is so, as Bryce said, it's odd. You sort of stop and think, what?
Yeah.
What's this? And then you're completely unprepared for this story and this person who you come to really care about. And that's so skillfully done, and you're not really quite aware of it until you sort of look back at it, or you have to sit and talk about it, how skillfully done that is.
And has it made anybody else like it has me wanting very much to go to Rising Asia and see some of this?
Oh yeah.
I mean, I've never been to Pakistan or India, but it's certainly maybe keen, but I'll probably take my own water with me, maybe. I don't know. Thank you very much, Bronwyn, Briar and Stella. Hopefully you have all been encouraged to go and read this novel, and I do recommend reading The Reluctant Fundamentalist, but particularly I'd say his first novel, Moth Smoke, which I think is more like this one in that sort of real sense of vibrancy and a real sense of Pakistan. I mean, The Reluctant Fundamentalist was very much a novel ultimately about the US, but these are two novels really about Pakistan, and we know so much less about Pakistan than we do about the US, just through the way that, that America filters into our lives so much more. Thank you very much indeed for listening. We'll be back next month with Kate Atkinson, Life After Life. That's our book choice for what month are we heading into? I do believe it is April, isn't it? Yes, April. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.